coming. They will kill us all. You girls do not understand.
Yvette stood up and walked over to her. She looked up at the girl with no name. The hens pecked and clucked around Yvette's flip-flops. Listen, darling. These ain't men's coming to kill you. I told you before. These is chickens. They is more scared of us than we is of them. Look you. Yvette put her head down and ran into a group of hens. There was a great explosion of flapping wings and flying feathers, and the hens were jumping up onto the mattresses, and the girl with no name was screaming and screaming and kicking at the hens with her Dunlop green flash trainers. Suddenly she stopped screaming and pointed. I could see where she was pointing, because there were hen feathers everywhere, falling down in the bright beams of sunshine from the skylights. Her pointing finger was trembling, and she was whispering, "Look, look, my child." All of us girls were looking, but when the feathers finished falling, there was nothing there. The girl with no name, she was just smiling at a bright beam of sunlight on the clean grey-painted floor. There were tears falling from her eyes. "My child," she said, and she held her arms outstretched toward the beam of light. I watched her fingers trembling. I looked at Yvette and the sorry girl. The sorry girl looked down at the floor. Yvette shrugged at me. I looked back at the girl with no name, and I spoke to her. "What is your child's name?" The girl with no name smiled. Her face shone.
"This is Abira. She is my youngest. Isn't she beautiful?"
I looked at the place she was looking. "Yes, she is lovely." I looked at Yvette and made my eyes wide at her. "Isn't she lovely, Yvette?" "Oh, yeah, sure. She a real heartbreaker. What you say you calling her?"
"Abira."
"That's nice. Listen, Abira, why don't you come with me and help me chase the fowls out of this barn?" And so Yvette and the sorry girl and the youngest daughter of the girl with no name, they started chasing the hens out of the building. Me, I sat and held the hand of the girl with no name. I said, "Your daughter is very helpful. Look how she chases those hens." The girl with no name, she was smiling. I was smiling too. I think it was nice for both of us that she had her daughter back. If I was telling this story to the girls from back home, then one of the new words I would have to explain to them is efficiency. We refugees are very efficient. We do not have the things we need, our children, for example, and so we are clever at making things stretch a little further. Just see what that girl with no name could make out of one little patch of sunlight. Or look how the sorry girl could fit the entire color of yellow into one empty see-through plastic bag. I lay back on the bed and looked up at the chains. I was thinking, that sunshine, that color yellow, maybe I will not see very much of these now. Maybe the new color of my life was gray. 2 years in the gray detention center, and now I was an illegal immigrant. That means you are free until they catch you. That means you live in a gray area. I thought about how I was going to live. I thought about the years living as quiet as could be, hiding my colors and living in the twilight and the shadows. I sighed, and I tried to breathe deeply. I wanted to cry when I looked up at those chains and thought about the color gray. I was thinking, if the head of the United Nations telephoned one morning and said, "Greetings, little bee. To you falls the great honor of designing a national flag for all the world's refugees," then the flag I would make would be gray. You would not need any particular fabric to make it. I would say that the flag could be any shape, and it could be made with anything you had. A worn-out old brassiere, for example, that had been washed so many times it has become grey. You could fly it on the end of a broom handle if you did not have a flagpole. Although if you did have a spare flagpole, for example, in that line of tall white flagpoles outside the United Nations building in New York City, then I think that old grey brassiere would make a fine spectacle, flying in the long, colourful line of flags. I would fly it between the stars and stripes and the big red Chinese flag. That would be a good trick. Thinking about this, I made myself laugh. What the hell you laughing at, Bug? I was thinking about the color gray. Yvette frowned. Don't you go crazy too, please, Bug, she said. I lay back on the bed and I looked up to the ceiling, but all that was there were those long chains dangling down. I thought I could hang myself by the neck from those, no problem. In the afternoon, the farmer's wife came. She brought food. There was bread and cheese in a basket and a sharp knife to cut the bread with. I thought, I can cut open my veins with that knife if the men come. The farmer's wife was a kind woman. I asked her why was she doing this good thing for us. She said it was because we were all human beings. I said, excuse me, miss, but I do not think Yvette is a human being. I think she is another species with a louder mouth. Yvette and the farmer's wife started laughing then, and we talked for a little while about where we had all come from and where we were going to. She told me the direction to go to Kingston-upon-Thames, but she also told me that I shouldn't. You don't want to go to the suburbs, dear, she said. Neither fish nor flesh the suburbs. Unnatural places, full of unnatural people. I laughed. I told her, maybe I will fit right in. The farmer's wife was surprised when we asked for 5 plates instead of 4, but she brought them anyway. We divided the food into 5 portions, and we gave the biggest helping to the daughter of the woman with no name, because she was still growing. That night I dreamed about my village before the men came. There was a swing that the boys had made. It was the old tire of a car, and the boys had tied ropes around it and suspended it from the high branch of a tree. This was a big old limber tree, and it grew a little way apart from our homes, near to the schoolhouse. Even before I was big enough to go on the swing, my mother would sit me down in the dark red dust by the trunk of the limber so I could watch the big children swinging. I loved to listen to them laughing and singing. 2, 3, 4 children at once, all ways up, with legs and arms and heads all tangled up and dragging in the red scrape of dust at the lowest point of the swing. Aye! Ouch! Get off me in the name of God! Do not push! There was always a lot of chatter and joking around the swing, and up above my head in the branches of the limber tree there were grumpy hornbills that shouted back at us. Enki Ruka would get down from the swing sometimes and pick me up in her arms and give me little pieces of soft, uncooked dough to squeeze between my chubby fingers. Everything was happiness and singing when I was a little girl. There was plenty of time for it. We did not have hurry. We did not have electricity or fresh water or sadness either, because none of these had been connected to our village yet. I sat in between the roots of my limber tree, and I laughed while I watched Enki Ruka swinging back and fro, back and fro. The tether of the swing was very long, so it took a long time for her to travel from one end of its swing to the other. It never looked like it was in a rush, that swing. I used to watch it all day long, and I never realized I was watching a pendulum counting down the last seasons of peace in my village. In my dream, I watched that tire swinging back and fro, in that village we did not yet know was built on an oil field and would soon be fought over by men in a crazy hurry to drill down into the oil. This is the trouble with all happiness. All of it is built on top of something that men want. I dreamed of watching Enki Ruka swinging back and fro, and when I woke up, there were tears in my eyes, and in the light of the moon, I was watching something else swinging back and fro. I could not tell what it was. I wiped the tears from my eyes, and I opened them fully, and then I saw what it was that was swinging through the air at the end of my bed. It was a single Dunlop green flash trainer. The other one had fallen off the foot of the woman with no name. She had hanged herself from one of the long chains that reached up to the roof. Her body was naked, apart from that one shoe. She was very thin. Her ribs and her hip bones were sharp. Her eyes bulged open and pointed up into thin blue light. They glittered. The chain had crushed her neck as thin as her ankle. I watched the Dunlop green flash trainer and the bare dark brown foot with its grey sole swinging back and fro past the end of my bed. The green flash trainer glowed in the moonlight like a slow and shining silver fish, and the bare foot chased it like a shark. They swam circles around one another. The chain squeaked quietly. I went and touched the bare leg of the girl with no name. It was cold. I looked over at Yvette and the sari girl. They were sleeping. Yvette was muttering in her sleep. I started to walk over to Yvette's bed to wake her, but my foot slipped on something wet. I knelt down and touched it. It was urine. It was as cold as the painted concrete floor. A puddle of it had collected underneath the girl with no name. I looked up, and I saw a single drop of urine hang from the big toe of her bare foot, then sparkle as it fell to the floor. I stood up quickly. I felt so depressed about the urine. I did not want to wake up the other girls, because they would see it too, and then we would all be seeing it, and then none of us could deny it. I do not know why the small puddle of urine made me start to cry. I do not know why the mind chooses these small things to break itself on. I went over to the bed that the girl with no name had been sleeping on, and I picked up her T-shirt. I was going to go back and use the T-shirt to wipe up the urine, but then I saw the see-through plastic bag of documents on the end of the bed. I opened it and started to read the story of the girl with no name. The men came and they... That was how all of our stories started. I was still crying, and it was difficult to read in the dim light from the moon. I put the girl's documents back down on the bed, and I closed the bag carefully. I held it tightly in my hands. I was thinking, I could take this girl's story for my own. I could take these documents, and I could take this story with its official red stamp at the end of it that tells everyone it is true. Maybe I can win my asylum case with these papers. I thought about it for 1 minute, but while I held the girl's story in my hands, the squeaking of her chain seemed to get louder, and I had to drop her story back down on the bed because I knew how it ended. A story is a powerful thing in my country, and God help the girl who takes one that is not her own. So I left it on the girl's bed, every word of it, including the paper clips and all the photographs of the scar tissue and the names of the missing daughters, and all of the red ink that said this was confirmed. Me, I put one small kiss on the cheek of Yvette, who was still sleeping, and I walked off quietly across the fields. Leaving Yvette, that was the hardest thing I had to do since I left my village. But if you are a refugee, when death comes you may not stay for 1 minute in the place it has visited. Many things arrive after death. Sadness, questions, and policemen. And none of these can be answered when your papers are not in order. Truly there is no flag for us floating people. We are millions, but we are not a nation. We cannot stay together. Maybe we get together in ones and twos for a day or a month or even a year. But then the wind changes and carries the hope away. Death came, and I left in fear. Now all I have is my shame, and the memory of bright colors, and the echo of Yvette's laugh. Sometimes I feel as lonely as the Queen of England. It was not difficult to know which way to go. London lit up the sky. The clouds glowed orange, as if the city that awaited me was burning. I walked uphill, through fields with some kind of grain, and into a high wood of some kind of trees, and when I looked back down toward the farm for the last time, I saw a floodlight come on outside the barn they put us in. I think it was an automatic light, and standing in the middle of the beam, there was the single bright lemon-yellow dot of the sari girl. It was too far away to see her face, but I imagined her blinking in surprise when the light came on, like an actress who has walked onto the stage by mistake, like a girl who does not have a speaking part, who is thinking, "Why have they turned this great light upon me now?" I was very scared, but I did not feel alone. All through that night, it seemed to me as if my big sister Enkiruka walked beside me. I could almost see her face, glowing in the pale orange light. We walked all night, across fields and through woods. We stared around the lights of villages. Whenever we saw a farmhouse, we went around that, too. Once, the farm dogs heard us and barked, but there was no trouble. We kept on walking. My legs were tired. 2 years I had been in that detention center, going nowhere, and I was weak. But although my ankles hurt and the backs of my legs ached, it felt very good to be moving, and to be free, and to feel the night air on my face and the grass on my legs, wet from the dew. I know my sister was happy too. She was whistling under her breath. Once when we stopped to rest, she dug her toes into the earth at the edge of a field and smiled. When I saw her smile, I felt strong enough to carry on. The orange glow of the night faded, and I started to see the fields and the hedges around us. Everything was grey at first, but then the colours began to come into the land, blue and green, but very soft, as if the colours did not have any happiness in them. Then the sun rose, and the whole world turned to gold. The gold was all around me, and I was walking through clouds of it. The sun was blazing on the white mist that hung over the fields, and the mist swirled around my legs. I looked over at my sister, but she had disappeared with the night. I smiled, though, because I realized that she had left me with her strength. I looked around me at the beautiful sunrise, and I was thinking, "Yes, yes, everything will be beautiful like this now. I will never be afraid again. I will never spend another day trapped in the color gray." There was a low roaring rumbling sound ahead of me. The noise rose and fell in the mist. "It is a waterfall," I thought. "I must be careful not to fall into the river in this mist." I walked on, more carefully now, and the noise got louder. Now it did not sound like a river any more. There were individual sounds in the middle of the roaring. Each sound got louder, rumbling and shaking, and then fading away. There was a dirty, sharp smell in the air. Now I could hear the sound of cars and trucks. I went closer. I came to the top of a green grass slope, and there it was in front of me. The road was incredible. On my side of it, there were three lines of traffic going from right to left. Then there was a low metal barrier, and another three lines of traffic going from left to right. The cars and the trucks were moving very fast. I walked down to the edge of the road and put out my hand to stop the traffic, so I could cross. But the traffic did not stop. A truck blew its horn at me, and I had to step back. I waited for a gap in the traffic, and then I ran across to the center of the road. I climbed over the metal barrier. This time a great many car horns were blown at me. I ran across and up the green grass bank at the other side of the road. I sat down. I was out of breath. I watched the traffic racing past below me, three lines in one direction and three lines in the other. If I was telling this story to the girls from back home, they would be saying, "Okay, it was the morning, so the people were traveling to work in the fields." But why do the people who are driving from right to left not exchange their fields with the people who are driving from left to right? That way everyone could work in the fields near to their homes. And then I would just shrug, because there are no answers that would not lead to more foolish questions like, what is an office, and what crops can you grow in it? I just fixed the motorway in my mind as a place I could run back to and kill myself very easily if the men suddenly came, and then I stood up and carried on going. I walked for another hour across fields. Then I came to some small roads, and these roads had houses on them. I was amazed when I saw them. They were two stories high and made out of strong red bricks. They had sloping roofs with neat rows of tiles on them. They had white windows, and there was glass in all of them. Nothing was broken. All the houses were very smart, and each one looked like the next. In front of nearly every house, there was a car. I walked along the street and stared at the shining rows of them. These were beautiful cars, sleek and shining, not the kind of vehicles we saw where I came from. In my village there were two cars, one Peugeot and one Mercedes. The Peugeot came before I was born. I know this because the driver was my father, and my village was the place where his Peugeot coughed twice and died in the red dust. He went into the first house in the village to ask if they had a mechanic. They did not have a mechanic, but what they did have was my mother, and my father realized he needed her more than he needed a mechanic in any case, and so he stayed. The Mercedes arrived when I was 5 years old. The driver was drunk, and he crashed into my father's Peugeot, which was still standing exactly how my father had left it, except that the boys had taken one of its tires away to use as the seat of the swing on the limber tree. The driver of the Mercedes got out, and he walked over to the first house and met my father there, and he said, "Sorry." And my father smiled at him and said, "We should be thanking you, sir. You have really put our village on the map. This is our very first road traffic accident." And the driver of that Mercedes, he laughed, and he stayed too, and he became great friends with my father, so much that I called him my uncle. And my father and my uncle lived very happily in that place, until the afternoon when the men came and shot them. So it was astonishing to see all these new, beautiful, shining cars parked outside these big, perfect houses. I walked through many streets like this. I walked all morning. The buildings got bigger and heavier. The streets got wider and busier. I stared at everything, and I did not mind the hunger in my stomach or the aching in my legs, because I was amazed by each new wonder. Each time I saw something for the first time, a nearly naked girl on an advertising billboard, or a red double-decker bus, or a glittering building so tall it made you dizzy. The excitement in my stomach was so fierce it hurt. The noise was too much, the roar of the traffic and the shouting. Soon there were such crowds on the streets that it seemed I was nothing. I was pushed and bumped all over the pavements, and no one took any notice of me. I kept on walking as straight as I could, following one street and then another. And just as the buildings got so big, it seemed they could not possibly stand up, and the noise got so loud it seemed as if my body would be shaken to pieces, I turned a corner, and I gasped and ran across one last busy road with car horns blasting and the drivers screaming, and I leaned over a low white stone wall and stared, because there in front of me was the River Thames. Boats were pushing along through the muddy brown water, honking their horns under the bridges. All along the river, to the left and the right, there were huge towers that rose high into the blue sky. Some were still being built, with huge yellow cranes moving above them. They even trained the birds of the air to help them build. Wah! I stayed there on the bank of the river, and I stared and stared at these marvels. The sun shone out of the bright blue sky. It was warm, and a soft breeze blew along the bank of the river. I whispered to my sister Enkiruka, because it seemed to me that she was there in the flowing of the river and the blowing of the breeze. "Look at this place, sister. We are going to be all right here. There will be room for two girls like us in a country as fine as this. We are not going to suffer any more." I smiled, and I walked away down the embankment of the river in the direction of the west. I knew that if I followed along the bank, I would get to Kingston. That is why they call it Kingston upon Thames. I wanted to get there as quick as I could, because now the crowds in London were starting to frighten me. In my village, we never saw more than 50 people in one place. If you ever saw more than that, it meant that you had died and gone to the city of the spirits. That is where the dead go, to a city, to live together in their thousands, because they do not need the space to grow their fields of cassava. When you are dead, you are not hungry for cassava, only for company. A million people were all around me, their faces hurried past. I looked and looked. I never saw the faces of my family, but when you have lost everyone, you never lose the habit of looking. My sister, my mother, my father, and my uncle. Every face I see, I am looking for them in it. If I did meet you, then the first thing you would have noticed would have been my eyes staring at your face, as if they were trying to see someone else in you, as if they were desperate to make you into a ghost. If we did meet, I hope you would not take this personally. I hurried along the river embankment, through the crowds, through my memories, through this city of the dead. Once, beside a tall stone needle engraved with strange symbols, my legs burned and I needed to rest, so I stood still for a moment, and the dead flowed around me like the muddy brown Thames flowing around the pillar of a bridge. If I was telling this story to the girls from back home, I would have to explain to them how it was possible to be drowning in a river of people, and also to feel so very, very alone. But truly, I do not think I would have the words. Chapter 4. Early on the morning of Andrew's funeral, before little B arrived, I remember looking down from the bedroom window of our house in Kingston upon Thames. Out by the pond, Batman was poking at baddies with a plastic junior golf club, looking skinny and forlorn. I wondered if I should warm up some milk and make him a cup of something. I remember wondering if there was anything that could be put into a cup that would actually be of practical help. My mind was set in that crystalline, self-conscious state that comes with lack of sleep. Beyond our garden, I could see the whole street's back gardens, curving away like a bent green spine, with barbecues and faded plastic swings for vertebrae. Through the double glazing came the braying of a car alarm and the drone of planes climbing out of Heathrow. I pressed my nose against the glass, and I thought, these bloody suburbs are purgatory. How did we all wash up here? How did so many of us end up so very far downwind? In the garden next door, on that morning of the funeral, my neighbour was hanging out his blue Y-fronts to dry. His cat was curling around his legs. In my bedroom, the Today programme was on the radio. John Humphreys said the FTSE was rather badly down.
"Yes, but I have lost my husband,"
I said it out loud, while a trapped fly flew feebly at the window pane. I said, "My husband is dead, I'm afraid. My husband, Andrew O'Rourke, the celebrated columnist, has taken his own life, and I feel..." Actually, I didn't know how I felt. We don't have a grown-up language for grief. Daytime shows do it much better. I knew I ought to feel devastated, of course. My life had fallen apart. Isn't that the phrase? But Andrew had been dead nearly a whole week now, and here I still was, dry-eyed, with the whole house reeking of gin and lilies, still trying to feel appropriately sad. Still drilling down through the memories of my short, mixed life with poor Andrew, searching for the capstone, the memory which, when cracked, would release some symptom of anguish. Tears, perhaps, under unbelievable pressure. All of this would have been easier on daytime TV. My life entered a vicious downhill spiral, Tricia. I couldn't imagine getting through the day without him. It was exhausting prospecting for grief like this, unsure if grief was even there to be found. Perhaps it was just too soon. For the moment I felt more pity for a trapped fly that buzzed against the window. I opened the latch, and out it flew, vulnerable and weak, back in the game. On the other side of the glass, the day smelled of summer. My neighbour had shuffled along his washing line, 3 feet to the left. He'd finished pegging Y-fronts. Now he was on to socks. His washing hung like prayer flags, petitioning daytime gods. "I seem to have moved to the suburbs, I'm afraid. Can anything be done?" A thought of escape presented itself, rascalish and unannounced. I could simply leave right now, couldn't I? I could take Charlie, my credit card, and my favourite pink shoes, and we could all get on a plane together. The house and the job and the grief would all shrink to a point behind me. I remember realising with a guilty thrill that there was no longer one single reason for me to be here, far from the centre of my heart, cast away here in its suburbs. But life is not inclined to let any of us escape. That was the moment I heard a knock at the door. I opened the door to little B, and for the longest time I simply stared at her. Neither of us spoke. After a few moments I let her in, and I sat her down on the sofa. Black girl in a red and white Hawaiian shirt, stained by the Surrey clay. Sofa from Habitat. Memories from hell. "I don't know what to say. I thought she must be dead." "I am not dead, Sarah. Maybe it would be better if I was." "Don't say that. You look very tired. You need some rest, I should think." There was a silence that went on too long. "Yes, you are right. I need some rest." "How on earth did you... I mean, how did you survive? How did you get here?"
"I walked."
"From Nigeria?"
"Please, I am very tired."
"Oh, yes, Of course, yes. Would you like a cup of, you know? I didn't wait for the answer. I fled. I left little B sitting on the sofa, propped up on the John Lewis cushions, and I ran upstairs. I closed my eyes and rolled my forehead against the cool glass of the bedroom window. I dialed someone, a friend, more than a friend, actually. That's what Lawrence was.
"What is it?" said Lawrence.
"You sound cross."
"Oh, Sarah, it's you. God, I'm sorry. I thought you were the nanny. She's late, and the baby's just been sick on my tie. Shit."
"Something's happened, Lawrence."
"What?"
"Someone's turned up I really wasn't expecting."
"Funerals are always like that. All the old skeletons come theatrically out of their closets. You can't keep the bastards away."
"Yes, of course. But this is more than that. It's...
I stammered away and fell silent. "Sorry, Sarah. I know this sounds awful, but I'm in a terrible rush here. Is it something I can actually help with?" I pressed my flushed face against the cold glass.
"Sorry, I am a bit confused."
"It's the funeral. You're going to feel a bit scatty, aren't you? I'm sorry, but there's no way around that. I wish you'd let me come. How are you feeling about it all?"
"About the funeral?"
"About the whole situation."
I sighed. "I don't feel anything. I feel numb."
"Oh, Sarah."
"I'm just waiting for the undertaker now. I'm slightly nervous, maybe. That's all. Like waiting at the dentist's."
"Right," said Lawrence carefully. A pause. In the background, the sound of Lawrence's children squabbling at the breakfast table. I realized I couldn't tell Lawrence about little B turning up. Not now. It suddenly didn't seem fair to add it to his list of problems. Late for work, baby sick on tie, tardy nanny. Oh, and now a presumed dead Nigerian girl resurrected on his mistress's sofa. I didn't think I could do that to him. Because this is the thing with being lovers. It isn't like being married. To remain in the game, one has to be considerate. One has to acknowledge a certain right to life of the other. So I stayed silent. I listened to Lawrence taking a deep breath on the edge of exasperation.
"So what's confusing you? Is it that you're not feeling anything much and you think you should be?"
"It's my husband's funeral. I should be sad, at least."
"You're in control of yourself. You're not a gusher. Celebrate that."
"I can't cry for Andrew. I keep thinking about that day in Africa. On the beach."
"Sarah?"
"Yes?"
"I thought we agreed it was best that you forget all that. What happened, happened. We agreed that you were just going to move on, didn't we?"
"Hmm?"
I pressed my left hand against the window pane and stared at the stump of my lost finger. "I don't think moving on is going to work anymore, Lawrence. I don't think I can just continue to deny what happened. I don't think I'll be able to. I..." My voice trailed off.
"Sarah, deep breaths."
I opened my eyes. Outside, Batman was still poking fiercely at the pond. The Today program scolded away on the radio. Next door, the neighbor had finished pegging his washing, and now he simply stood there, eyes half closed. Soon he would move on to a new task. The percolation of coffee, perhaps, or the application of replacement twine to the spool of a string trimmer. Small problems. Neat problems. "Now that Andrew's, well, gone, Lawrence, do you think you and I will be..." A pause at the other end of the phone. Then Lawrence, careful Lawrence, non-committal.
"Andrew didn't stop us while he was alive," he said. "Do you see any reason to change things now?"
I sighed again.
Sarah.
Yes?
Just focus on today for now, will you? Focus on the funeral. Hold it together. Get through today.
Stop smearing that fucking toast on the computer!
Lawrence?
Sorry, that was the baby. He's got a piece of buttered toast and he's wiping it all over. Sorry, have to go.
Lawrence hung up. I turned from the window and sat on the bed. I waited. I was putting off having to go downstairs and deal with little B. Instead of moving, I watched myself in the mirror as a widow. I tried to find some physical sign of Andrew's passing. No extra line on the forehead. No darkening of the skin under the eyes. Really? Nothing? How calm my eyes were since that day on the beach in Africa. When there has been a loss so fundamental, I suppose that to lose just one more thing, a finger, perhaps, or a husband, is of absolutely no consequence at all. In the mirror, my green eyes were placid, as still as a body of water that is either very deep or very shallow. Why couldn't I cry? Soon I would have to go and face a church full of mourners. I rubbed my eyes, harder than our beauty expert's advice. I needed to show red eyes to the mourners at least. I needed to show them that I had cared for Andrew, truly cared for him. Even if, since Africa, I hadn't really bought the idea of love as a permanent thing, measurable in self-administered surveys, present if you answered mostly B. So I gouged my thumbs into the skin beneath my lashes. If I couldn't show the world grief, at least I would show the world what it did to your eyes. Finally, I went downstairs and stared at little B. She was still sitting there on the sofa, her eyes closed, her head propped on the cushions. I coughed, and she snapped awake. Brown eyes, orange-patterned silk cushions. She blinked at me, and I stared at her, with the mud still caking her trainers. I felt nothing. "Why did you come here?" I said. "I did not have any other place to go. The only people I know in this country are you and Andrew."
"You hardly know us. We met, that's all." Little B shrugged.
"You and Andrew are the only ones I met," she said. "Andrew is dead. We are going to bury him this morning."
Little B just blinked at me glazedly.
"Do you understand?" I said. "My husband died. We are going to have a funeral. It's a kind of ceremony. In a church. It's what we do in this country."
Little B nodded.
"I know what you do in this country," she said. There was something in her voice, so old, so tired, that terrified me. That was when the door knocker sounded again, and Charlie answered the door to the undertaker and called down the hallway, "Mummy, it's Bruce Wayne." "Run out and play in the garden, darling." "But, Mummy, I want to see Bruce Wayne."
"Please, darling, just go." When I came to the door, the undertaker glanced at the stump of my finger. People generally do, but rarely with that professional gaze that notes, "Left hand, second finger, first and second phalanx. Yes, we could fix that with a wax prosthetic, a slender one with a light Caucasian flesh tone, and we could use Kryolan foundation to cover the join, and we could fold the right hand over the left in the coffin, and Bob would be your mother's brother, madam."
I was thinking, clever undertaker. If only I was dead, you could make a whole woman out of me.
"My deepest condolences, madam. We are ready for you whenever you feel ready to continue."
"Thank you. I'll just get my son and my, well, my friend." I watched the undertaker ignoring the smell of gin on my breath. He looked back at me. There was a small scar on his forehead. His nose was flattened and skewed. His face registered nothing. It was as blank as my mind.
Take all the time you need, madam.
I went out into the back garden. Batman was digging away at something under the roses. I went over to him. He had a trowel and he was lifting a dandelion, pulling its root to the tip. Our resident robin was hungry, and he watched from 6 yards away. Batman raised the dandelion from the soil and brought it close to examine its root. Kneeling, he looked up at me.
"Is this a weed, Mummy?" he said.
"Yes, darling. Next time, if you're not sure, ask before you dig it up." Batman shrugged.
"Shall I put it in the wild patch?" he said.
I nodded, and Batman carried the dandelion over to a small part of the garden where Andrew had given a home to such rascals, in the hope that they would attract butterflies and bees.
"In our small garden, I have made a wild place to remind me of chaos," Andrew once wrote in his column. "Our modern lives are too ordered, too antiseptic." That had been before Africa.
Batman bedded in the dandelion among the nettles.
"Mummy, is weeds baddies?"
I said that it depended if he were a boy or a butterfly. Batman rolled his eyes, like a newsman interviewing an equivocating politician. I couldn't help smiling.
"Who is that woman on the sofa, Mummy?"
"Her name is Little Bee."
"That's a funny name."
"Not if you're a bee."
"But she isn't a bee."
"No, she's a person. She's from a country called Nigeria."
"Hmm. Is she a goodie?"
I stood up straight. "We have to go now, darling," I said. "The undertaker is here to collect us."
"Bruce Wayne?"
"Yes."
"Is we going to the Batcave?"
"Are we going to the Batcave?"
"Are we?"
"Sort of."
"Hmm. I is coming in a minute."
I felt the perspiration starting on my back. I had on a grey woolen suit and a hat that was not black, but a late-evening nod to it. It didn't scorn tradition, but nor had it entirely submitted to darkness. Folded up over the hat was a black veil, ready to bring down when the right moment came. I hoped someone would tell me when that was. I wore navy blue gloves, which were borderline dark enough for a funeral. The middle finger of the left-hand glove was truncated and stitched. I'd done it 2 nights earlier, as soon as I was drunk enough to bear it, in a merciful hour between insobriety and incapacity. The glove's severed finger was still lying on my sewing table. It was hard to throw away. In my suit pocket was my phone, set to quiet mode in case I forgot to do it later. I also had a £10 note ready for the collection, in case there was a collection. It seemed unlikely at a funeral, but I wasn't sure. And if there was a collection, was £10 about right? 5 seemed ridiculously mean, 20 obscenely flashy. There was nobody left to ask about ordinary things. Little Bee was no use. I couldn't ask her, "Are these blue gloves okay?" She'd only stare at them, as if they were quite the first pair of gloves she had ever seen, which was quite possibly the case. "Yes, but are they dark enough, Little Bee? Between you and me, you as the refugee from horror, and me as the editor of an edgy monthly magazine, would we call that shade blue courageous or blue irreverent?" Ordinary things were going to be the hardest, I realized. There was nobody to ask about them. This was something undeniable, now that Andrew was gone. There was nobody left with a strong opinion about life in a civilized country. Our robin hopped out from the foxgloves with a worm in its beak. The worm's skin was puce, the color of bruising.
Come on, Batman. We have to go.
In a minute, Mummy.
In the quiet of the garden, then the robin shook his worm and swallowed its life from the light into darkness with the quick indifference of a god. I felt nothing at all. I looked at my son, pale and bemused, in the neatly planted garden, and I looked past him at little Bee, tired and mud-stained, waiting for us to go through into the house. So, I realized, life had finally broken through. How silly it looked now, my careful set of defenses against nature. My brazen magazine, my handsome husband, my marginal line of motherhood and affairs. The world, the real world, had found a way through. It had sat down on my sofa, and it would not be denied any longer. I went through the house to the front door to tell the undertaker we would be with him in a minute. He nodded. I looked behind the undertaker to his men, pale and hungover in their coattails. I have drunk gin myself in my time, and I recognized that solemn expression they wore. One part pity, three parts I'll never drink again. The men nodded at me. It is a peculiar sensation, as a woman with a very good job, to be pitied by men with tattoos and headaches. It's the way people will always look at me now, I suppose, as a foreigner in this country of my heart I should never have come to. On the street in front of our house, the hearse and the limo stood waiting. I went out into the driveway to look through the green glass of the hearse. Andrew's coffin was there, lying on bright chrome rollers. Andrew, my husband of 8 years. I thought I should feel something now. I thought, rollers, how practical. On our street, the semi-detached houses stretched to infinity in both directions. The clouds scrolled across the sky, blandly oppressive, each one resembling the next, or threatening rain. I looked back at Andrew's coffin, and I thought about his face. I thought about it dead. How slowly he had died over those last 2 years. How imperceptible it had been, that transition in his facial expression from deadly serious to seriously dead. Already those two faces were blurring together for me. My husband alive and my husband dead, they now seemed only semi-detached, as if under the coffin lid I would find the two of them fused like Siamese twins, eyes agape, looking to infinity in both directions. And now this thought came into my head with the full clarity of horror. Andrew was once a passionate, loving, brilliant man. Staring at my husband's coffin, I clung to this thought. I held it up before my own memory like a tentative flag of truce. I remembered Andrew at the newspaper we both worked for when we met, having a shouting match with his editor over some lofty point of principle that got him gloriously fired on the spot and sent him striding fierce and beautiful into the corridor. The first time that I thought, this is a man to be proud of. And then Andrew practically tripping over me, eavesdropping in the corridor, open-mouthed, pretending I was walking past on my way to the newsroom. Andrew grinning at me unhesitatingly and saying, "Fancy buying a former colleague a spot of dinner?" It was one in a billion. It was like catching lightning in a bottle. The marriage cooled when Charlie was born. As if one lightning strike was all we got, and most of the heat from it had to go into our child. Nigeria had accelerated the cooling, and now death had finished it. But my dissatisfaction and my affair with Lawrence had come first. That was what my mind was stuck on, I realized. There was no quick grief for Andrew because he had been so slowly lost. First from my heart, then from my mind, and only finally from my life. This, then, was when real sorrow arrived. This was the shock that sent me trembling,
as if something seismic had been released deep inside me and was blindly inching toward the surface. I trembled, but there was no release of tears. I went back inside the house and collected my son and little B. Mismatched, dazed, semi-detached, we walked to my husband's funeral. Still shaking in the pew, I understood that it isn't the dead we cry for. We cry for ourselves, and I didn't deserve my own pity. After it was all over, someone or other drove us home. I clung on to Charlie in the back seat of a car. I remember the car smelled of stale cigarettes. I stroked Charlie's head and pointed out the everyday things that we passed, invoking the comfort of houses and shops and cars by the hopeful magic of whispering their names. Ordinary nouns were what we needed, I decided. Everyday things would get us through. Never mind that Charlie's Batman costume was covered in grave mud. When we got home, I put it in the wash and gave him the clean one. When it hurt too much to prise open the box of washing powder, I used the other hand. I remember sitting with Charlie while we watched the water flood into the machine, rising behind the round glass door. The machine lurched into its familiar grinding preamble, and Charlie and I had a perfectly ordinary conversation. That was the worst moment for me. We talked about what he wanted for lunch. Charlie said he wanted crisps. I demurred. He insisted. I acquiesced. I was a pushover at that moment, and my son knew it. I conceded on tomato ketchup and ice cream, too, and there was triumph in Charlie's face and horror in his eyes. There was extraordinary pain behind the ordinary nouns. We ate, and then little B took Charlie out into the garden to play. I had been so focused on my son that I had forgotten all about her, and it actually surprised me that she was still there. I sat very still at my kitchen table. My mother and my sister had come back with us from the church, and they orbited me in a blur of fussing and tidying, so that if a photograph had been taken of us all with a very long exposure, it would have shown only me, in sharp focus, surrounded by a ghostly halo that took its azure colour from my sister's cardigan and its eccentricity from my mother's tendency to close in on me at one end of her orbit and ask if I was all right. I hardly heard her, I think. They carried on around me for an hour, respectful of my silence, washing the teacups without unnecessary clink, alphabetizing condolence cards while minimizing rustle, until I begged them, if they loved me, to go home. After they left, with tender drawn-out hugs that made me regret banishing them, I sat back down at the kitchen table and watched little B playing in the garden with Batman. I suppose it had been reckless of us to abandon our home and spend the whole morning at a funeral. In our absence, some baddies of the worst stripe had occupied the laurel bush, and now had to be flushed out with water pistols and bamboo canes. It seemed to be dangerous and painstaking work. First, little B would creep up to the laurel on her hands and knees, with the hem of her oversized Hawaiian shirt dragging in the dirt. When she spotted a lurking baddie, she would jab at him with a yell, causing him to break out into the open. There my son was ready with the water pistol to deliver the coup de grace. I marvelled at how quickly they had become a team. I wasn't sure I wanted them to be. But what was I to do? To stride out into the garden and say, "Little B, could you please stop making friends with my son?" My son would loudly demand an explanation, and it would be no use telling him that little B wasn't on our side. Not now that she and he had killed so many of those baddies together. No, it wasn't going to work any more denying her, or denying what had happened in Africa. A memory can be banished, even indefinitely, deported from consciousness by the relentless everydayness of running a successful magazine,
mothering a son, and burying a husband. A human being, though, is a different thing entirely. The existence